Can you hear me?
Hello.
No, I don't think you can hear me. How do I change it?
Everyone should be connected. Yes.
Oh, it's
Salam!
working?
Hey, it's working.
Oh.
The focus is mainly talking about like life experiences of women's in general and specifically Muslim women, because I feel like there is a missing narrative from Muslim women on their perspective, anything related to education, arts, STEM, whatever, the guest would be interested in talking about, but really like to discuss things, because often I find people talk about Muslim women, but they don't invite them, kind of, or have a lot of assumptions of, and they're like, oh no, maybe they're not interested, maybe they're shy, they're like modest, don't want to talk about this stuff. And the other part is like looking for inspiration. I really You're my role model in terms of like really seriously in terms of like pursuing your dreams, trying new things, it's like traveling, mashallah, mashallah. Yani, it's like not everybody can do this, they feel like, oh, why should I do it? Oh, maybe I won't feel comfortable, or about traveling and being a woman, Yeah, if we can start talking about that.
So where shall I be in? Where should
So maybe like if you can, what do you do now?
Right now, I am a web developer for a renewable energy company. So I build
Mashallah.
web applications and websites for internal and external use. So if you go to the company's webpage that I worked on that, I put that together, but also the internal sales apps and customer relationship management apps, worked on components for those too. So that's what I do right now. I've been a developer for since August of 2018. So
And before that,
right before that, I was a teacher. I taught English internationally for 3 years. And before that, I was a retail construction project manager, which basically means that I managed the construction of retail stores for almost 10 years.
wow, 10 years, that's like a very long experience.
I had hit my 9 year anniversary, and it was a big retailer.
Was that in Chicago when we
Well,
first met?
I started in Philadelphia, and then I was
Oh.
promoted and transferred to the Chicago office, the Midwest office. So there I was over Eastern United Central United States and Eastern Canada, as opposed to just a small portion of the East Coast. And I was there, I when I hit 9 years, I realized like there's still people there that have been there 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, because the benefits are really good, the workload is very light, and
So you liked it
I did not
pretty
like it.
much.
I was bored out of my
Oh.
mind. I was finished my work any day. If I worked consistently, I was finished my work by Tuesday morning. But it was a results-oriented work environment, so I could be anywhere and work. So I would not go into the office Monday, probably Tuesday, if I didn't have any meetings. Wednesday, I would go in because there were reports that I wanted to print.
Oh, so wait, you said result
Yeah,
work environment?
so there's a book about it, results-oriented work environment. So we would, quote unquote, row. So you didn't have to be in the office. This is, I guess, the predecessor to our current environment, working at home.
That's nice. That's actually very nice. More flexible.
So I wouldn't go in, we're downtown Chicago, so I wouldn't go in to the office on Monday because there was still a lot of tourist traffic, and maybe I probably wouldn't go in on Tuesday. And then Wednesday, I would go in to print reports, and maybe Thursday. And then Friday, I probably wouldn't go into the office because, again, tourist traffic. So yeah, it was a really easy job, but I was bored out of my mind. I could think of nothing. I would just remember thinking, like, I don't want to die and have this be my legacy that I worked.
Wow, so that was the moment when you said, okay, career change.
Yeah, it was probably in 2014, maybe even before that, like before I moved to Chicago, when I was still in Philadelphia. I grew up most of the time in Philadelphia. It was really secure, and I thought I wanted to. I made a list of things that I wanted, like if I died tomorrow, I would.
Oh, tell me more about this list.
Yeah, I am 2012, so I had turned 30. It was a big turning point for me. I had kind of decided that I kind of decided that I love to travel. So I'd done some traveling for the past couple of years, had some big trips. I was going to,
Outside of the US.
yeah, so
Okay.
outside and inside. So I'd gone to, Hawaii and Alaska. I'd also gone to Morocco a couple times, Fiji, a couple countries in Europe, like I don't know, 7 or 8 countries in Europe. My rule then was, when I turned, I think when I turned 30, I was like, if someone asks me to go on a trip or invites me on a trip, I will go. Like no question.
Oh, okay. So you're not you're not a solo traveler.
At that
You
point,
can
I
travel with a
wasn't
group.
in 2010, 2011, I was not a solo traveler. It never really crossed my mind to go alone. I'd grown up pretty strict Muslim,
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so
It's
you
like, what
travel.
if something happens and nobody
Yeah, and
around? What are
it's
you
not,
doing this
some people say it's not permissible if it's not necessary,
mm.
unless you're traveling with, a group of Islamically knowledgeable women, or you're traveling to gain knowledge, Islamic knowledge, then you're not supposed to travel by yourself. Or without, the ideal situation is with, a male relative, a male guardian. And there is a caveat that is what I use. It's that if you're teaching people about Islam, you're exposing people to Islam. And that's what I use as my Islamic validation, is that when I travel, I am a Muslim woman. I am presenting Muslim.
Yeah, that adds to the purpose of the
Yeah.
whole trip and
Presenting not only to, like, a lot of times with the people I travel with, or my closer travel group, but also just the community at large. I'm exposing them to Muslim women. A lot of times I'm the first Muslim woman that they've had a chance to talk to. So that's what I use as my Islamic validation to travel. I'm not saying anyone else should, but I am okay with the travel that I do solo.
But that's like a very important point, you know, the first encounter of a Muslim woman when like with other people. I'm sure like there's a lot of, I don't know, like perceptions, expectations or things like that. What's if you can tell us about like a story of one of your travels that you're like people told you something or
Yeah, it's, it's funny. Usually in the larger world, the only thing they know is that you're not like them. So when I went to Costa
We capitalize on the difference, like,
yeah,
yes.
it was just, when I went to Costa Rica, it was just that, it wasn't that I was Muslim, it wasn't that I was black, it was that you're not Costa Rican. And that was, they had lots of questions about just not being Costa Rican and, the similarities and differences. And the same with China. It wasn't so much that I was Muslim, because China has lots of Muslims. It was, and the fact that I was black was very unique, but even beyond that, it was that I was not Chinese. And so they had a lot of questions, and
So is that because of the country, they don't have a lot of tourists, or are they like fairly homogenous? So
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a very homogenous, it's a huge country, very homogenous. It up until even now, I think it's one of the most difficult countries to get a tourist visa for, right up there with Saudi Arabia. So it's not easy to get into. And it's intimidating to a lot of travelers who have a lot of preconceived notions about it.
Is that you're talking about Costa
No,
Rica
China.
or
Yeah.
China? Yeah.
And they I also was not in one of the big tourist spots, so Shanghai or Beijing are considered the big tourist, the biggest tourist
Yeah.
cities. I was in a more Chinese tourist city, and even then, you figure a lot of China's very much in de still in development, so a lot of people were from the more rural areas, and so they were coming to the big city, and they were like, "Wow, in the big city, there are non-Chinese people. Take a picture with me." So yeah, that's what
Like they would stop you and ask you to take a
Yeah,
picture
they would
with them.
stop and ask if they could take a picture. And I didn't speak Chinese, they didn't speak English, and they would just kind of pantomime, "Will you take a picture?" And because China is such a restricted country, I knew these pictures were not going anywhere but around China. So I didn't really worry about it, I just wonder, I was definitely the dinner conversation that night.
Yeah, that maybe they shared the picture with their
Oh yeah.
relatives and friends, and
And
they were
even
like,
like, the babies and things like that, it was fun. It's fun.
"For how long you went there to
Yeah, I
teach, right?"
taught English at a private boarding school, and I was there for just about 2 years.
2 years, that's a long time.
Yeah, either I think, I mean, it's a very different life. It's an easy life, but being a non-Chinese person, you start to feel like a spectacle, and that gets tired.
In terms of
Well,
what?
just like I said, where people would ask me to take pictures. I mean, that happened every time I went out to the grocery.
Oh, okay.
So
Yeah.
that gets tiring. Which is why I think I went to the Middle East next, because I just wanted to just blend in and have the easy life, and just not, I just wanted to blend in, like
But for 2 years, you've lived in the same
the same city.
city. And the boarding school was like for girls and
It was,
boys.
yeah, it was a co-ed boarding school. It went from first grade to 12th grade. And I taught first through sixth grade. They were at the school from Sunday, like Sunday midday, until Friday midday. And I taught Monday through Friday.
Interesting. And how's their school
It's
system?
very strict.
Very
Yeah,
strict. Okay.
compared to the Middle East, they are polar opposites. They went to school from 7 to 7, so 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And it was usually like 45 minutes of teaching and then 15-minute break each hour. The younger children, it was more like 40 minutes teaching and then 20 minutes of break. Most children had, or this was a very, affluent group of children. So they had extra classes on Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays, and even their lunch breaks. So one of the English classes that I taught was
Extra classes, like, is it like an
in
additional
addition
to do more
to
exercises,
the
or
addition to the
is it?
7 to 7, the Chinese really value
Oh,
it. Yeah.
wow.
And it was,
They live in the school
yeah,
almost.
and
It's
I
long.
mean, the parents, they also, most Chinese people work 6 days a week. They may get one day off or a half a day per week off. So a lot of times the parents were working, and the kids were raised by their grandparents. So them being in boarding school made it easier for the parents, so that they didn't have to worry about their children. So yeah, it's really different.
It's very different than, so I'm from Saudi Arabia and I've done all my schooling in Saudi in I don't know. It's really different. Like, I loved the school when I was a kid. My mom is a teacher, so it's important as like a value of okay, doing good in school, having a good grade. That's very important part of your future, and decide, and based on that, you can decide which, I mean, major or college you're applying to. Education is for free, so we didn't have any issues of like financially, but like some people hated school, so I don't think they would love to be in boarding school for a long time. But again, it's like and the number of hours, I'm so shocked. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot of hours being away from
Yeah,
home.
they were it was hard
And
for the younger kids. There was a lot of tears, you know, in the first grade class. That was, you know, usually the first time they'd been away from home. And
They have like a summer break where.
well, they do take a break. They take a month off for Chinese New Year and then usually 2 months off in the summer. But again, if you're affluent, if you're wealthy, you send your children to summer school. So those kids maybe get a week or 2 weeks, and then they go to a summer school program.
Interesting. I think in Saudi, I remember the summer break was almost 3 months.
Yeah, they give you a break
And usually.
between
Oh, go
two
ahead.
holidays, right? The two Muslim holidays.
Ramadan usually is like at least the last 10 days of Ramadan is a break. And sometimes also they give you another break in around Hajj. And also, and if it's like, I don't know, the summer is around, I don't know, August. We don't use August. I've lived in this state for a long time. No, I forgot. But they give us like I think maybe I don't remember, maybe after Al-Hajj, they'll give us 2 or 3 months of studying. Then after that, like okay, you're on a break. So like in total you only studied, I don't know, for 7 months max. And when you moved to the Middle East, where did you live?
I lived in Dammam. I also lived in Khobar, because I taught in Qatif, which is I don't know if you know Eastern
East.
Providence. Of course you know. It's on the eastern side.
I've never been, by the way. When you asked me, I remember before you went, you asked me about it. I was like, I'm from the West Coast.
Completely different right now.
I've never been there.
Yeah, now
I can tell you a few things, but I don't have any experiences.
it's a really it's an interesting area because that's where Saudi Aramco, well, Aramco oil is, right?
Yeah,
But
that's like that plays a major part in the people. I mean, not just education, in terms of healthcare, they offer for their employee, of course, hospitals, and that covers their. Health services. They build stuff. They started this. It's an cultural center, Isra. So they do a lot of projects for the people in that area.
And the compound is amazing. Like if you get the, I think for anyone, this is anyone, if you get the chance to work for Saudi Aramco, if they take you, and they pay for your family, they pay for everyone, take it because it is like the lap of luxury. They take care of all your needs and you live in this compound. It's not even compound, it's like a little city.
There's a lot of foreigners. It's not just only
No,
Saudis, maybe
it's I
mainly.
would almost say it's mostly foreigners because probably the Saudi people live outside the compound.
True,
But
yeah.
it's yeah, it's just so like it's like technologically advanced. Like they test things, you know, the buses, you know, self-driving and Wi-Fi and all these different things, like it's a really fun experience, and you get to live with a fun group of expats, people that are, you know, well traveled and easygoing mostly. And yeah, it's a great way to try international living.
Yeah, so you lived in, though you lived in a different city,
Yeah, I
right?
lived in
In Dammam.
so I taught for a a business college, a women's business college that was a joint venture between a British organization and the Saudi government. And I taught in Qatif, which is a Shia area, kind of like more, it's stricter, it's more, in Saudi terms, it's more rural. So it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. And I live.
It's very traditional.
Very also. Traditional. So full, you know, in Dammam, because there's so many Westerners, you know, all the women wore abayas, but, you know, you would see women without their hair covered or very loosely covered, very easily covered. Whereas in Qatif, a lot of the women covered their face fully, you know, so they.
Even if they're not. Okay. Yeah. So maybe it's like a customary.
Yeah. So.
To the point that you can't do the opposite.
So. Which is why a lot of us didn't live in Qatif, because it was such a strict area with strict family groups and things like that.
They didn't have any like housing options for people who teach in that college.
Yeah, they housed us in a building called the Pink Palace, but
Pink Palace.
It was, the name was kind of ironic. It wasn't a palace at all. I think it was in Hobart, near the water. So. It was an okay area, but the living conditions were, you had a roommate in the apartment, you know, two bedrooms, one bath, a kitchen, a living room. And the alternative was a living allowance. And if you were like me, you know, brown and, you know, could kind of fake your way to, you know, fake it as a Middle Eastern person, or new people, you know, like I could just stay quiet and nod and whatnot, then you could get a much better deal and kind of pocket the rest of your living allowance. So I only stayed at the Pink Palace, I think, 2 or 3 months before I found my own place. Even like it was technically a long-term hotel, but they would do the cleaning and, you know, I could live by myself. And I think I used maybe half of my living allowance. So those in the know, we didn't live, you know, we found our own places, and you kind of, with the other teachers, you would share a driver to take you back and forth to the school. This is before women could drive.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So maybe this is not, maybe I'll cut this part or maybe I'll keep it. But like, because I've been here in the state for almost 8 years and I didn't witness the driving part as like for a long time. I only go home over Christmas break. So every time I go, like now for 2 years, because they started in 2018, I'm shocked. I'll be like, oh, that's a woman driving. Oh, my sister is, she has a car. So it's like, because it's been the norm for a long time, to the point you'll be like, is this normal? Why did we do that before? How come did we accepted as a like a thing before? This is such a necessity. It's very important.
Well, I talked to a lot of my drivers when I was there, because, you know, I talked to everyone, and it was really a point of pride that their women didn't have to drive and didn't have to work.
Yeah, I get that part of the culture because I'm from the culture, but again, it's like there's a lot of inconvenience. Yeah. I mean, everybody can speak to that. Even the, I see some rich people, they're like, okay, we already have drivers. Even if we allowed us to drive, we already have drivers, so we don't worry about it. For people from like average middle-income families like mine, it's a lot of inconvenience to pay for something that you can, or like have a driver, you have to pay for visa, you have to pay for, it's also like, I don't know, it doesn't make sense. I don't know.
No, yeah, I think it's, I mean, there may have been a point in time where each family had one, you know, one person that drove around.
And we have to fight about, I remember that clearly. Like, I need to go to this mall. Mom, no, your sister needs to get this, so we have to wait. So it's, and we don't have, the other part is like, we don't have any form of public transportation. So there is no alternative whatsoever. No buses, no, like there are buses. I've used the bus to go to Mecca, to Medina, the train, but it's not like in-city service. Yeah.
And there, I mean, what we used, there was Uber and Careem, so.
Oh yeah, that, and also like even in other Middle Eastern countries, a lot of bloggers or vloggers, they create travel blogs. And people are really, I'm sure a lot of people who have never been, they would watch the videos and be like, okay, this is fun. The people are just, they want to ask you who you are, where are you from, why are you here, and we'll help you
Yeah,
do
they're
whatever
not.
you need to do. I mean, they're interested that you're coming already to their
And I think
country, so they
that's
want to show you around.
something that may be a cultural difference. Like in the United States, we don't really have people over. You don't invite people that you don't know for dinner. And in other places, most areas of the world, Asia, Africa, they do.
That's the
So,
first thing. Oh, come to our
and it's a
place.
big deal, you
We'll
know,
offer
to
you
turn
lunch.
them down, you have to be very delicate about the way you say no, you know, you have to have a good reason. And when you get there, you have to, you know, do follow the local customs and you have to eat their food, you know, and you can't say like, oh, I'm vegan and oh, you know, that's. It's not a thing. And so you turn people's food, you know, they invite you into their home and, you know, you turn down their food, you turn down their hospitality. Like that's not a good thing. And that's something that is unusual for Americans. If you haven't dealt with a lot of people from outside of the United States.
Yeah, and I think they take it as so hospitality is a big part also of the religion in general, and that you're hosting somebody in your house, you make sure they're comfortable, they're if they need, I mean, accommodations or directions or anything, that's kind of your duty to
It's
do.
like you if you're if you go to an American
Yeah.
person's house, it's not unusual for them to not offer you anything. I'm saying like average American, you know, if they're a Muslim American, I hope they offer you something. They have enough to offer you, you know, a drink, a snack or something. But like average American, it's not unusual. And I remember, I don't remember what I was reading. And they, you know, they, someone had them over and they were like, they gave them tea, but that was it. It was just like the teacups. They were like, that's it. Like, can I get, like, is she really not going to give me, like, any cookies, any biscuits? Like, she didn't make a dessert. Can I at least get some, you know, some nuts or something? Like, they were so appalled. So, yeah, it's yeah.
Yeah, the customs are different. The customs are very different, but it's also that's also a beautiful thing
It
to
is. It is. And
see
it's
when you're
something I've brought home.
traveling.
Like, if someone comes over, I love that feeling of having, like, so casually being welcomed. Like, I don't know how they do it. Maybe you can tell me how. But it's like you stop by, and, you know, within an hour, there's like, not only have you had like tea and snacks, sweet and savory, but there's a whole dinner being prepared, like a whole meal. And it's like, well, are you just cooking this? Or is this for me? Like, how are you ready instantly? You know, you go into motion and, you know, they sit out and everyone's just, you know, you feel so welcome. And so, like, that's one of the things I try to do. I haven't quite gotten it down to a science, but like, I can make you tea. I will have something. Like, if I don't have it ready, I can prepare like a quick, you know, snack, you know, appetizer or something to like welcome you into my home because that's how it should be done, you know? That's how you welcome, you show someone that you care about their presence.
Yeah, and it's so again, my families they're a little bit more reserved. So even the people who visit us usually are just family or friends or people we work with. But in general, in Saudi, no, you invite people if you meet them, even like on the road, somebody needs something. Oh no, come home. You call your family and be like, okay, prepare the tea and coffee. I have a couple of people coming.
Yeah,
That's like very normal
it's a
thing to
great
do.
thing, and I wish more Americans did it.
So are there people around you, like American, either Muslim or non-Muslims, who traveled like to the Middle East and
Well,
just for
not
fun?
necessarily for fun, but in Philadelphia, there's a Muslim community, a Black American Muslim community is very large and very old. And one of the things that makes it unique is that although we're American, so a lot of I know a bunch of people my age. I just turned 40. So in the 80s and 90s, their families moved to the Middle East. Either Saudi Arabia or Egypt.
Oh, they
Yeah.
moved, like relocated permanently.
So that they could get
Wow.
an Islamic education. And then they come back.
Wow,
Yeah, they come
mashallah,
back.
that's
A lot of
amazing.
them, they go, they get their education, they come back, or people will send their children to be educated, and then, the kids come back. So we have a community here that's very Black, very American, but also very Muslim, And you see that when you move around, you'll see women in all Black. You'll see men, they wear, their thobes every day. Very dark.
Yeah, I remember. So I really love social media a lot because I remember, like maybe 2 years ago, there was a video of I think it's from Philly. I'm not sure, and they're going to Hajj. So there's a big bus, a group of people who are traveling on the bus, and I th believe they're going to Hajj. And the relatives and friends are saying goodbye to them, singing. I don't remember what was it, but maybe Tala al Badru Alayka or something. It was like an Islamic song. And truly, I feel like, oh my God, they're all Americans and we've never seen anything like this before. This is so beautiful.
I mean, I know there's a big masjid here that they do a Hajj send off, and it's kind of like a yearly event.
A
Where
Hajj send
everyone,
off,
usually
okay.
they leave as a group. So it's where, everyone gets their documents and, their luggage. They're going on a bus to New York usually to fly out. And everyone, everyone gathers to get the blessings of sending them off. People give their du'as that they want to be made, or sometimes just give their name and say, make du'a for me. They give money and, hoping to give, you give the money to the people going on Hajj and get the blessings for it. So yeah, it's a big deal. I know people that, even like I've only been once when my mom went, but I know people that it's part of their yearly ritual. They go to the Hajj send off. They take something like little bags of like treats and toiletries that you can use when you travel, or they give money. Like they do it every year. It's part of their yearly
Oh, so they give it to
yeah.
the people who are traveling for Hajj,
If they're not
even if they
related,
don't
they're not
like.
family.
Oh my
They
gosh.
usually like you
Wow.
can it's such a big thing. They do practices, so before that you join the group, you say you want to go. They practice, they do like practice walking and this is what it will be like. They have classes and things to say this is what it will be like, how to prepare yourself. So everyone knows usually the number of people, and then they'll make little goodie bags and things for the number of people that are going. It's really a beautiful thing that the community supports.
Somebody should make a
About
video,
little
please, or a
prophets.
movie about it, a film about
Yeah.
it, because we really need to learn how Muslim communities all around the world prepare for Hajj. This is like a
Yeah, I
very
would love
important thing we experience
Yeah,
that
I would
includes
love to see that.
traveling.
The people who've been doing it here in Philly, they've been doing it for like 20, 30 years. Like they've been doing it for a long time. And I know there's a man in Canada, he's the same way. He's been
Okay, I wanna ask you about. You talked about being Muslim
Yeah.
women and black. So this is like, I'm not sure how to ask this, but when you travel to the Middle East and also to China or anywhere else, how do you how do people perceive you, or how did you like deal with certain expectations? Yeah. I'm not sure what the question is, but like, how do you carry yourself? I've been fortunate
that I haven't had any trouble. I haven't been, you know, like, stopped. Well, that's not true, but I haven't had any major trouble. The closest I came was in Kenya. We were stopped. Our car was stopped by the police, and they questioned us, and they checked our passports, and it was me and two British women, and I guess they basically decided we weren't worth the trouble. So they just kind of said, like, you'll buy me lunch today. And so we had to give them some money. Yeah.
really?
And we gave them money and then they let us go. I know other people, they had to go further. Like, they were at the police station and had to call someone to bring more money. And, you know, they were let go. So that's, alhamdulillah, that's the closest I've come to having any type of trouble. I'll say that, like I said, I try to just do as the locals do. So dress as the locals do. I don't wear like fancy things or take fancy things, name brands and things like that. I can remember being in Morocco and I was so happy because that was the first time I'd seen a halal McDonald's. I'd gone in and gotten like a Big Mac or something and had gotten food to go and planned to go back to my hotel. And I think we were in Marrakesh. But then I realized, you know, I kept seeing people look at my bag, my McDonald's bag. And I realized that, you know, McDonald's is expensive for the average person in Marrakesh. So if they see me with a McDonald's bag, they think I have money.
Oh.
So I just kind of tucked it into a shopping bag, like a regular reusable shopping bag, so that it wasn't attracting more attention. I try to be aware of things like that, be sensitive to things like that. And not flaunt my Americanness. So learn, you know, the local language so that I can at least say, you know, hi, bye, thank you, in that language.
Even if the people understand English or speak English, you have to know at least few words to show them that you're
easier. You know, whatever transaction, it's respectful, I think. You want to show the people that you respect them and where you are. So even, and another phrase that I learn is, you know, do you understand English or do you speak English? So don't assume that person speaks English. I ask them to speak English and then I can continue in English. Mm-hmm. And that's for any country, you know. What else? I do things I do to safeguard myself. I think for the most part, most of the world is brown. So as a brown person, I think it's easier traveling as a brown person than a white person. Yeah, because white people unfortunately signal money, you know, and foreign in a lot of places. And so if you're brown, they assume.
Oh, so it takes harder from their parts.
And if you're brown, you can kind of blend in and people don't, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not very tall. So maybe if I was like a 7-foot man, you know, it'd be different. But they don't assume that you have money or that you're trouble. That's, again, where speaking a little of the local language comes in handy because, you know, I'm trying to ride that I'm not a foreigner wave as long as I can. I try to make sure I arrive during the daylight hours and it gives me plenty of time to get where I need to go before nightfall. That's just good practice, you know, as a
So going out when it's like the sun is out.
I try to be in a busy area. Like, I may have to pay a little more to be close to the city center. I look for reviews from other single women to see, like, oh, you know, walked around at night, had no issues, or, you know, I always check in with the front desk or the door person, you know, so they know I'm coming and going. And they'll keep an eye on you, I think, you know. they'll check on you, they'll make sure you're okay. So I've had times where I said, yeah, I'm going here, and they said, well, maybe don't go there by yourself. I'll have someone go with you. And I'm not going to say no, I'm fine, or I want to leave now, not in 2 hours. I'm going to take that person's advice and wait for some company. So I think people in general, people are much kinder outside of the United States. Yeah, I think so.
Oh
And
no.
even, I would say to a certain extent in the more rural areas of the United States, like, they're used to looking out for other people. They're not going to let you suffer or let something bad happen to you. It doesn't matter, just no money involved or anything. Like, they look out for people. So, if you keep,
Yes, yeah.
you act respectfully, you treat them with respect, you act humbly, then people will take care of you. That's what I've found in my travels.
But I think maybe if we can go over, because some of the countries you visited are non-Muslim countries, so like when you were in
How did I
China,
navigate
how?
being a Muslim in some countries? So I think the hardest thing is the dietary restrictions, making sure things are halal, or in countries like China, or even some European countries, like Eastern European countries, where there's a lot of pork because it's cheap. Making sure that I know where I stand in that country. So I do some research before I go to see, like, are there a lot of Muslims there? No. If there are Muslims there, then usually you can find, like, there's halal food. Like Fiji, there's a lot of Indian Muslims in Fiji. So, you could find halal places, or if you asked a Fijian person, if you told them, I don't eat pork or something like that, they would understand. Vietnam is the same way. Well, no, Vietnam is different. They do have Muslims, but they also have people who are vegetarian. So if you say, yeah, I'm vegetarian, and
Yeah,
you
that's the
can
safer
find that
option.
actual phrase in Vietnamese, then they know, like, okay, this is what you can have. So that's another thing I learned how to say, like, is there meat or is there pork? In China, they really it's the way the language is, if it said meat, it was probably pork, because it's cheap. Chicken was, like, a little different because they have eggs, but then they would specify, like, lamb or beef, because that's a more expensive cut. And so I learned very quickly to recognize the symbol for meat, aka pork, and then whether there was another symbol added to it to say it was lamb or beef or chicken. That's probably the biggest thing. I travel, compass and your own rug, your own prayer clothes, because outside of the Middle East, in, like, Asia, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, you're usually fine. You have to find the direction yourself.
The direction,
I
yeah,
may
good
also
luck.
do a quick Google search to see if there's a mosque in the area. But also, depending, like, in Indonesia, there are masjids all around, but, like, I wasn't sure how men and women interacted. So, yeah, and since I didn't speak,
Oh, inside the
the
space.
language, I didn't speak Indonesian, and I was in kind of just, like, a residential area. I was like, oh, I'll just, I go and I visit during the off hours, but I wouldn't go for, like, Friday prayer or anything like that.
That's a very important part because I don't know if you're familiar with the project's
No, I didn't know there was a
side
project called Side Entry.
entrance. Yeah, so oh my gosh, I'm blinking on her name. How come? I think her name is Hint. I met her in Chicago and she created this project where she documents visually and like in photos and also like writes on a blog about how Muslim women areas or spaces for prayer in mosques are usually like a very
They're
small room,
completely bad. Well,
or maybe the
yeah, in the
back
United States,
or
they don't tend to
the
be nice.
ground.
Saudi Arabia has a really nice one.
But still, it's much smaller than the male area. That's not a nice thing to do because you really you're saying that okay, more women comes to the mosque.
Yeah. All
Do
the kids are
they?
there,
What
right?
about
Like
Eid?
the
We need a
women, the kids are
space.
with the women, so they need, a more well-appointed space. So yeah, that's something. Like, unless I have a woman that I know in the area, I wouldn't go to like Friday prayer or during the busy times at the masjid. What else do I consider? I think that's pretty much it. Like, other than that, you can kind of, I entertain myself and, go where I like to go, museums and walking tours and things like that. Men in most countries are fairly, the countries I've been to, I haven't been to like Italy and Greece, which I hear are a little worse, but they're pretty respectful, or at least forward. Yeah. So if you
On your
don't give
space and
them
your
that
look, yeah.
opening, then they won't take it. Sometimes you have to be a little rude. Like, even in the Middle East, they find out you're American and they think,
Yeah, the assumptions that you're okay with, yeah, with a
Yeah, you
handshake
have to shut
and
that
like,
down. And
nope,
you may
I don't
feel,
shake
I feel a
hands.
little rude sometimes when I do it, but times when I've tried to be more polite, they didn't get the message, which is, I think, universal. So you have to be a little more.
What do you do usually? I put my hands on my chest and be like, I don't do, like, out of respect. Okay, I'm putting my right hand on my chest and like, I
Same.
got what you're
Like,
trying to
you
do,
just
but
kind of
I don't
like,
shake hands.
give a nod and, move away, like make your hands inaccessible. I try just not to like make have personal conversations. Like, if you're into this area of talking about myself, it's kind of strange, or it's kind of hard to specify, but
It's kind of an
there's a point in
invitation to,
conversations where things will kind of go into a more personal area, and you have to kind of steer it toward more, general things, and
I
it really is,
think that's
and
everywhere.
it's a skill hopefully like women everywhere kind of have to learn. It's just like, you have to make up an excuse, you make up a friend, someone's meeting me somewhere. I've learned to talk in more general, like not I, me, it's we. We live here and we have a house here and we're going here, so don't assume it's just me by myself. Yeah, just more
Oh, that's a
general.
nice step for safety
It's
also.
hard, kind of, especially if I'm very secure in who I am and my place in life, but I don't want to give people more information than they deserve. So refer to things as we will be here, we are staying here, plural terms. Thanks for watching me because I was not Chinese. Out of interest.
Interesting. So when you're living abroad or you're living in a
Yeah.
different country, you're
You
kind
are,
of
not in a
noticed
bad
all the
way. And I think
time.
maybe some
You're on the
Americans and some
radar.
Black Americans, they think maybe there are racial implications to it. Like they think something bad is expected of them, but that's not usually the case. They're just watching you. Like, if I went into the grocery store in China, or the big store, like, they had like Walmarts and things. And I could be shopping for, let's see, cleaning products, right? And in China, there's so many people, like their customer service is that like each aisle has a person, like an attendant. And so like
Really?
if I went down an aisle,
Wow.
like they were all, it's not too crowded, so they'd, be chatting or whatever. If I went down an aisle, I would look back and I would see maybe two or three women watching. They're usually women, usually older women, watching me and talking. And I would, go about my business, shopping for whatever I was looking for. And sometimes they would come over and they would just like take whatever was in my basket out and replace it with something else. And which is like, I mean, that's auntie behavior everywhere, right? I would just say thank you. And they would, they would be talking the whole time. I had no idea what they were saying. But I just say thank you and say, like, auntie knows, you keep going. And then when I get to the cash register, there's always a person to like, there's the cashier, and then there's like the person that puts things in bags, right? And when I would get to the line, when I would, it was my turn, usually when I looked up, it was the cashier and the security guard and the person putting things in bags. And they would talk the whole time, and they would just talk about what I bought. Like, oh wow, she bought the right thing. Oh, yeah, the foreigners, they like these, and they would just watch the whole
Center of
thing. And oh,
attention.
she's paying cash, and it's just like, and then they will all say goodbye. Like they were smiling the whole time. This is why, after 2 years, it was like it was a lot, but everything was interesting, and yeah, you just kind of have to go with it and, laugh along and, be in good spirits. And that was it. We have a lot to learn, and I think it starts with traveling more, getting, Americans, young Americans outside of the United States to experience life and see that a lot of what you hear on the news is not true. That, the United States is good at very few things, unfortunately. And that, there are other ways to do things and get things done. And I think especially it starts with women. Everything starts with women. And I would say be safe, but don't let other people's fears stop you from doing the things that are important.
Do you have anything at the end to say about you?
Yes,
How can people find you if you're on social
if only.
media
I'm on
or if
many
you have a
things. I
blog
haven't
or something?
figured out what my I've been saying I'd do a blog and I haven't. But yeah, I'm on Instagram at Shaquilla Moni. That's the best way to find me. That's where I have the most fun.
We'll include that in the description of that episode as well.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for your time, Shakira.